I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Scott L. from Nashville, Tennessee.
Good evening. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm very honored to be here, and thanks to everyone who made it possible for me to come. I'm truly, truly touched, and I was thrilled to see all the people under 30 days. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to be fun. Who'd have thought it, huh? Who would have thunk it? I never would have. But I want to check something else, too, just for fun. Are there members of Al-Anon here? Can I see your hands? Thank you for coming. I am honored by your presence, and I mean that sincerely. My wife is a very active member of your fellowship, and I couldn't have the spectacular life I do without her program. I'm going to brag on her for a second. Let me tell you, her Al-Anon program is so good that when I'm pulling into a parking lot, she never helps me look for a parking place. What do you think? Did I say my name? Okay, yeah. Something in my home group we do when somebody gets, we don't do cakes, we do chips. When somebody gets a chip, we ask who in the room is sober that longer or longer. And I saw someone got a 1 year. Who here is sober a year or longer? You see the hands? Okay, thank you. And someone else got a 2 year. Let's see, 2 years or more. Okay, thank you. That's something I think is fun for the new people to see, that this thing's working for us. And I like to open my talks with a quote from Lois Wilson, who was co-founder of Al-Anon. She was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence. And she said, I invite God to the meeting. And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I do believe that. But something special happens for me when I stop and honor that presence. And so in a couple of seconds, I'm going to ask for a moment of silence. I'm going to ask all of you, if you would, to invite your God to join us, to fill this room with love, and to bless us with open hearts that you could hear through yours and that hopefully he would speak through mine, or in the worst case, that I would speak through it. And in case there's someone here who doesn't have a God, or you got one you're afraid of, or something's not working for you, borrow mine for this time we're together tonight. I'm serious about that. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Get you off on the right foot. And try it for an experiment just to see what happens. Nobody will even know. You can't be embarrassed by it. Let's take a couple of minutes and acknowledge the presence of deity. Amen. Thank you. That takes the heat off of me, doesn't it? I was asked to tell my story tonight. I found the directions here in the big book on page 29, where it says each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Now, that's not how I started my life. I started my life a victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I managed well. You recognize that? It's on page 61 in the text. What it says is that I'm so crazy that I think if I can get what I want, it will make me happy. I am a poor observer, right? I missed the tens of thousands of times that I got what I wanted, and I wasn't happy. I'll give you a couple examples. And by the way, I didn't fly 2,000 miles to talk to you. I come to talk with you. We're doing this together tonight, so get used to the idea. All right. Who, when you were a child, wanted a bicycle? You're sure if you got a bicycle, you'd be happy, and you got the bike. Come on. That's great. Thank you. Are you happy? All right, let's try another one. What you guys wanted her, you girls wanted him, you're sure if you got him, you'd be happy, and you got him. Let's see it. Okay, now you could be sitting with him. Someone do you a favor, not ask. I think I made my point. Or who was sure if you could get rid of him? Yeah, okay. Right. And see, my problem was that I had happiness and pleasure confused. I think pleasure is on the physical plane. It's of a limited duration. And there's something out there that I can get that will bring it. Happiness is inside. It's a side effect of having a healthy relationship with all of you and with God. And that's in part what the 12 steps are about. I didn't start drinking until I was 18 years old. I needed a drink way before then. I tell you when I needed a drink, a double shot of Cuervo Gold that first morning when I was going to kindergarten. Could you not have used a double that morning? Boy, that would have been perfect for me. But see, I didn't know what it would do. I didn't know what it would do, but I went away to college, and I was out with the fraternity boys at Fraternity Rush, and they started drinking beer, so I started drinking beer. I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like the way the bubbles felt. But I wanted to be in their fraternity, and so whatever they were doing, I was going to do it. And somewhere between the first sip of that first beer and the bottom of the second one, I got magic. I got magic. And I was suddenly taller. Anybody else get taller? A bit taller? Yeah. How about better looking? Did you get better looking? Yes. Yes. My pimples fell right off. I keep expecting to see that on the Super Bowl Budweiser ad. You know, Bud Light cures acne. Yeah. How about expert on many subjects? You smart? Yes, Lord, I got smart. Uh-huh. Fantastic dancer. Got a double on that? You bet. Yes, sirree. But the biggest thing that it did was it made me feel like I was as good as everybody else. I don't know how it happened to me, but sometime when I was very small, this predates my memory, I became convinced that I wasn't as good as everyone else. There are things wrong with me that cannot be repaired. And I became an actor as a small boy. And my act was that I pretended to be whoever I thought you wanted me to be. You is defined as whoever's immediately in front of me right now. And I was a different guy to everybody. At the end of my drinking, I had a customer in East Tennessee that was a very religious guy, and he knew me as a pretty religious guy. Had a customer 40 miles away who had a pretty good time on Friday night, and he knew me as a Friday night kind of guy. And then there was the guys in the pool room where I drank my beer and bought my dope, and they knew that. Me and I had business partners, they knew that one. I had family, I had neighbors. Everybody knew a different guy. And the greatest fear in my life was that people from different parts of my life would be in the same place, same time. How would I act? Right? Because I've been acting all my life. I've been acting so long that I don't have any idea who I am. The only thing I know for sure about me is that I don't measure up. And I'm not as good as everybody else. And if you all ever get in close and find out who I really am, you'll run me off. That's all I know for sure. And that second beer hit bottom. And all of a sudden, the transition was from, I'm afraid these fraternity boys will see through my act and run me off. We went from there to, these turkeys are pretty lucky I'm here. If you don't recognize that, that's an entire psychic change. That is exactly what that is. And that's why I think Dr. Silkworth says in the doctor's opinion, that's what I got to have to get over alcoholism, because that's what it did for me. If alcohol hadn't done so much for me, it could have never done anything to me. I zipped through a four-year college in 5 years and two summer schools. Thank you. Thank you. And in the mid-1960s, the United States Air Force was using the mirror test. They put a little mirror under your nostrils. If you could fog it, they would take you. And I fogged one, and they took me and sent me to Valdosta, Georgia, where I speak the language, to Air Force pilot training. And we flew the little Cessna 172 for about 6 weeks and moved to the T-37, which is about a 300-mile-an-hour twin-engine jet, fully acrobatic. And then for the last 6 months, we flew the T-38, which you're all familiar with. You don't know that you are, but you are. Everybody see Top Gun? See the movie Top Gun? Beginning of the movie, end of the movie, have the dogfight with the MiGs. Did you really think the Russian government had loaned Hollywood MiGs so they could... I really hate to do this to you. That black plane they called a MiG was actually the T-38, the Air Force's advanced jet trainer. When it came into the inventory, it took the climb record away from the F-104. This is it's defined as a high-performance aircraft. That means it has afterburning jet engines. It will fly faster than the speed of sound. It is stressed for about 7.5 positive Gs and about 4 negative. I'm going to try to tell you what that means in a minute. I have on a number of occasions gone from brake release on the runway to 40,000 feet in 3.5 minutes in this airplane. They do not have that ride at the fair. They ain't got that one. A loop in this aircraft, a loop is defined as a 360-degree turn through the vertical plane pulling positive Gs. At 10,000 feet in this airplane, you enter a loop at 500 knots, which is about 550 miles an hour, and you pull up at 5 Gs. Now, I'll explain that to you. You're pulling 1 G right now. It's the force of gravity. At 1 G, a 200-pound man weighs 200 pounds. At 5 Gs, a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds. That is precisely what that means. Everything on you weighs times 5. That includes your upper eyelids. And you will notice that at 5Gs if you work to keep them open. All right. 10,000 feet, 500 knots, 5G pull-up. We're wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. It takes 10,000 feet to pull her over on her back. We lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside. The total elapsed time of the maneuver is under 25 seconds. I tell you all of that for two reasons. The first one, of course, is to impress you. That's you. Okay. Mine's up. And the other one is because it tells the story of my alcoholism so well. I come down from a day of flying that aircraft, and I head over to the officers' club about 5:30 with no intention of getting drunk. Now, don't let me mislead you. I went out to get drunk a lot. I mean, that's the mission tonight. I'm going out to get drunk. Right? Did you ever just kind of take drunk? Did you ever get drunk by mistake? You know what I mean? Like maybe the guy in the next bar stool was contagious or something like that could have happened. Know what I mean? Yeah, okay. Had an epidemic of that, didn't you? Would you be willing to do audience participation with me? Let's try that again. Audience participation. Yeah, very good. When I point at you, I want you to fill in the blanks. You know the answers. We all have the same story. Okay. Heading to the club tonight. Not going to get drunk. Now, I've got a flight in this airplane tomorrow morning at 7:30. Right? Clearly not going to get drunk tonight. But I do want to socialize with the other pilots in my squadron. Right? So I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer. No more than two. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. That's the plan, right? Hey, by the way, I honored you earlier. I noticed some of you Al-Anons didn't play. I'd like to address you for just a minute. You know the answers to these questions, okay? Because this is what you heard on the phone. Didn't they? You know what they heard on the phone? Yeah. And you believed it again. That's why you have to come to Al-Anon. The ones that ran screaming from guys like me don't have to come to your thing, do they? No. Okay. Then I have one beer, no more than? I should be home by 6:30, no later than? That's the plan. But somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second beer, I get this phenomenon of craving. Dr. Silkworth talks about the doctor's opinion, and I don't get home by 7. As a matter of fact, I leave the officers' club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they... Jim, it's one of the biggest groups of pilots I've ever spoken to. I drive home with a hand over one eye. Who knows why? Okay, right, okay. My first wife tears into me. There's a lot of information in that sentence. She'll listen very closely to it. And then I go into the bathroom for what a friend of mine refers to as just after drinking chores. All right, let's see the hands of the pukers. Where are you? Come on, pukers. Yes, all right. How about nose pukers? Ever come out your nose? Where are the nose pukers? Yes. I'll tell you about nose pukers. Nose pukers quit forever when they're puking out their nose. Is that right? I quit forever over 2,000 times that way. And let me ask you something. Did you notice that you meant it every time? Huh? Well, every time I quit forever, and it was over 2,000 times, I meant it every time, didn't you? Yeah. Who quit solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses more than once? These are my people right here. Yeah. Okay. Let's try another. Who peed in the closet? I never did that. I'm so embarrassed for you. There's a difference between sharing in a meeting and a fifth step. You need to talk to your sponsor before you start admitting that kind of stuff in public. I'm really embarrassed for you. I never did that. I will admit that my first wife is still a little bit unhappy about that coffee table that used to be in the living room. Okay, I'll give you that. Who here has taken meetings into jails and prisons? Thanks for serving. That's my passion. I had the privilege of doing, I was in the jail Tuesday night in Nashville. That's just what I do. And it's such a joy. By the way, if anybody is suffering from depression, get with one of these people, take a meeting into the jail. It'll break your depression faster than anything else I know of, and unlike some of what's being prescribed for us, won't have a negative impact on your recovery. Forgive the soapbox. But I mean that. But I did that gag in the jail one night. Like 25 inmates. I said, who peed in the closet? One guy, right? We wore him out. When the laughter finally died down, he looked at me and said, hey, man, no big deal. Wasn't my closet. It's a perspective thing. So anyway, I'm in there puking my guts out, and I thought the two most important inventions of the 20th century were that half-moon shape of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on. That was invented by one of our guys, you know. His knees were all torn up from the terrazzo, you know, in the bathroom floor. He says, we ought to put... And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on, kind of in between heat, you know. I mean, tell me our people didn't invent that stuff. You know they did. Okay, so I'm in there bringing up my toenails and quitting forever. And then I called it the pre-AA prayer. It's not the literature as such. We're going to do it together. This is the pre-AA prayer. All right? I'm going to do the first line. You're going to do the second. Are you ready? God, get me out of this. Blech. You let that out. It's alcoholic for amen. Isn't it? I brush my teeth and go to bed, and it's got to be 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30 maybe. I get up at 6 in that wonderland between drunk and hungover. You remember that? Oh, I really miss that, don't you? Boy, that was great. Oh. And at 7:30 that morning, we released brakes in that airplane I was telling you about. And I am dying. 2-ship formation today. The Thunderbirds flew this plane for 7 years, and we did the things that they did. And just after liftoff, I've tucked under the leader's tail. If I could stand up in my cockpit, I can almost touch his afterburner. And we're going over the top at 5 G's at 500 knots. And I am dying in this cockpit. I've got, I call it the 4-6 hangover. It's the one where the butcher knife goes in here, sticks out the back. You remember that one? I was surprised the helmet went on over it. And, the eyelids are made out of sandpaper. The throat and nasal passages are rather raw from the unswallowing I was doing the night before. I've got, that's a nice term for puking, isn't it? Unswallowed, do you like that? I got a tremor in my hands. I'm sweating booze out of every pore. And the only thing that keeps me going is the sure and certain knowledge that I'll never feel this way in a plane again, because you see, last night I quit forever. And I meant it with all my heart. Didn't you? Meant it with all my heart. And what I've just described to you, by the way, is willpower. If you don't recognize that that's willpower, alcoholics have tremendous willpower. It's no defense against this disease, but boy, we got it. I got a friend that says he thinks that's the reason non-alcoholics don't become alcoholics, because they ain't got the willpower for it. I mean, the guy goes out on prom night. He drinks a pint and a half of Jack Daniels. He pukes on his date's dress. He wrecks his truck. He wakes up in the drunk tank. He says, I'm never doing that again. And he never does. Clear lack of willpower. You can see that. I know you can. Some people just don't have the gift. And by 5:30 that afternoon, I'm not well, but I was in my early 20s. My body's resilient. And there's no chance I'm getting drunk tonight. I got a flight tomorrow morning, 8:15. There's no chance I'm getting drunk. Nobody would ever get drunk before flying a plane like that. But I do want to socialize with other pilots in my squadron. So I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer, no more than. I should be home by 6:30, no later than. But I leave the club at exactly 1 because they. And I drive home drunk and I listen to her and I puke my guts out and God, get me out of this. Yeah, there was. There was an amen over there. Yeah. Over and over again. Over and over again. And I was powerless over alcohol, and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol, and that's a rough combination. And I'm a distinguished graduate from Air Force pilot training. 50 men graduated my class. 4 of us are distinguished graduates. I'm one of those. I just had the gift. No. I just had the gift. Some guys get into an airplane. Some of them put one on. I put one on. I just had the gift. And
I was to fly for 4 more years before I got out of the service. I got out with an honorable discharge, for those of you who think there's no God. And I've been drunk on 5 continents and don't have a guess how many islands. And I used to sit in cockpits and say to other pilots, I can't believe they pay us to do this. And I walked away from the greatest job I'll ever have, I guess, except for this one here. I wouldn't trade this one for that one. And I got a job as a sales rep, and in the summer of 1984, my business partner realized what was wrong with me. And he said, you're going to treatment right now, or we're done. And I couldn't dial my own home phone number in 3 tries. And I said, okay. And June the 28th, 1984, which is my belly button birthday, is also my sobriety date. And I got my 20-year chip last summer. And I want to tell you, the reason I mentioned it's my sobriety date, because that's one of the very few things I didn't have to change. And I also hadn't had to change the belly button birthday. And that's why I mentioned that. I'm sober since a couple of days before my first AA meeting. Slips are not part of recovery. Don't walk around thinking you've got to have one of those or it's something to be expected. It's not. It's not necessary. But I was put into a little charm school outside of Atlanta, Georgia, called Ridgeview. And I didn't sleep the first 3 nights I was in treatment. And they say for somebody who's doing the kinds of things I was doing, that's not real unusual. And I'm laying there the 4th night knowing I'm not going to sleep again. And some of you may recall, if you're not sleeping and you're not drinking, it stays dark a long time at night. And it's lights out at 11 and first call at 6:30, and you've got to stay in the bed in the room that day. It's a long time. And this 4th night I'm laying there, and a review of my life happened. I didn't do this. It happened. And I saw my life in little segments. And I'd always given myself credit for my intentions. I'm probably the best intended person you've ever run across. My favorite intention was I used to do close-up magic. And my intention was to get a clown suit. And when I was on the road, instead of running the bars, get in the clown suit, go to Children's Hospital, take my kid in and do a magic show for the kids. And I think everybody here would say it would take a really spectacular individual to do that. And I ain't done it yet. But but I was taking full credit for it because, you know, one of these days. Our third step talks about a decision. For me, the difference between an intention and a decision is an intention is followed by more intentions. A decision is followed by action. That's the difference. And this night laying in this bed in this treatment center, I couldn't see the intentions. And boy, it's not a pretty story without them. And I got to the place where I started thinking about the worst thing I've ever done. I've got one that stands alone. And I'd always been able to stop it before. You know, a couple of tokes on a joint will do that. A 6-pack will do it. 3 fast scotches. I could stop me. I'm laying in a bed in a treatment center. I can't even leave the room. And I could not get it stopped. And I lay there and thought about this thing for a while. We use the term bottom. I don't see the definition of it in my literature. So I'm going to tell you my experience with bottom. Is that bottom is not on the physical plane. I have puked blood more than once. I've been in plenty of kinds of trouble. I know men serving long prison sentences, not at bottom. Bottom for me was of the spirit. It was in here. Bottom was when I hated my guts at such a level and so repulsed by the things that I had done that I would have paid any price and done anything not to be me. That for me was bottom. And at that point, this part of me, this never happened up here, this part of me screamed to a God I don't think I believed in. God, forgive me. It was real loud, but it was from in here. And what I'm about to describe to you all happened in the next instant. Suddenly there was this magnificent light shining just on me and on my bed. With my eyes closed, I could see that room more clearly than I can see this one. Physically, the feeling was like when you've had x-rays taken of your teeth. When they finished, they picked that lead-lined blanket thing up off of you. It felt like something heavy, and I was unaware of it until that moment, was laying on me, and it flew up off of me at a very high rate of speed. And I felt so physically light, I thought I was going to float off of that bed. And I lay there in the presence of infinite love. And I knew in an instant that there was a God, that God had the power to forgive me, and I was forgiven. And I lay there in the Master's presence for a while. I've talked to others who've had similar experiences who agree when I say that what we call time doesn't exist in His presence. And I don't know if it was 2/10 of a second or 3 or 4 hours. I don't know how long I lay there in the Master's presence. And I must have slept because I woke up the next morning. And that was the first time I had awakened in the morning in several days. And I woke up wanting to be one of His guys. And that was my first cornerstone. And I'd like to read to you from the text for those who have not had one of those and feel like you're being shortchanged. This is page 12.
but soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. I'd like to tell you that I do not believe that experience alone would have kept me sober to tonight. I do not believe that. It was just a cornerstone I needed. I think I was the last gasp and didn't know it. Anyway, I started wanting what they had at the treatment center, and I changed, and they saw it immediately. A couple of weeks later, I was called into my counselor's office. He was working on my aftercare plan, and I knew that. That was the purpose of the visit. And I walked in there with a great attitude to help him design this aftercare plan. If you're new and don't know why that's funny, please listen to this. So I came through the door, and I said to him, and he's a member of Al-Anon, too. I'd like to salute you. The man saved my life. And he said, okay, aftercare plan. I'm not going to halfway house. I'm not taking an abuse, and you got a 28-day program. I'm not staying any longer than that. And I did that simply to lay out the parameters to help the man do his job. I was just being helpful. Okay, newcomers, here it comes. And he asked me the great question. And he said, really? I said, yeah. And he said, you've left out something you aren't going to do. I said, what? He said, you aren't going to make it. I took that personally. And I said to him, why'd you say that? Boy, is that ever not a quote. But that's the general idea. I mean, I didn't know his family, but anyway. I've noticed that the language of the heart doesn't have any profanity in it. Have you noticed that? I'm trying hard on that. I can report a lot of progress. But anyway, he said, you're not going to make it. And I eventually said, why? And he asked me the great question. He said, if you already know how to run a program to keep yourself sober, how is it you happen to be a patient here? And I responded by very cleverly saying, and nothing came out. I'd never had that experience before. I always had an answer, didn't you? I mean, you had to make some up, I know, but didn't you have an answer? Always had an answer. I can't answer this. I spent the rest of that day and on into the evening trying to answer the unanswerable question. I was walking back to my cabin about 9 o'clock that night, and I swear to you, the answer went, it hit me in the chest as I walked. This part of me knew the answer before this one did. And the answer was and is, I don't know how to run a program to keep myself sober. And if I'm going to be one of the very few that make it, I'm going to have to do it all. This is not a cafeteria lunch for me. I don't get to take what I want, leave the rest. I need to win this time. I need to win now. I cannot afford to not win now. And I do not care what the price is. I do not care what the price is. This is page 143. They just put this in the big book. You ever notice how they add things? Do you know what I mean? I mean, I swear I reached down and ran my finger across this to see if the ink would smudge. This was never been here. Page 143, we all had to place recovery above everything. How about that? Wow. So anyway, at that point, I surrendered what I lovingly call Step 1, Section B. Oh, yeah, I see. Okay. See, the reason I was... Now, this is important to me. This may not ring for you. The reason I was confused on June 27th, 1984, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and the fact that my life was a disaster and crashing down around my ears were related. On January the 15th, 2005, the fact that I am powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, are not related. And they're still true. My life's no longer insane, but I don't get to manage it. I have fired me as general manager of my own life based on my performance. A good manager would have fired me decades ago. And this morning, formally, I invited God in to run my life today. Yeah, not to give me a little help with this, and I'll take it from here. I wouldn't never wanted to work God too hard. I'll tell you what, I'll cover sex and money, he can get the rest. That's just not it. It's not the package. You know, it's two bowling balls. My will, God's will, pick one. So I invited him in to run my life this morning. My life's no longer insane. I can't find a place in this book after page 59 where it says our lives have become unmanageable all the way to the end. I can't find a place that says congratulations. Having now achieved this lofty spiritual level, your life is now manageable. The tank's full, the keys are in it, go get them. Somebody shout out the page number. I can send you to a couple of places that promise sanity. And part of my sanity is I'm not running my life anymore. It didn't work. So I surrendered to Step 1, Section B. I zipped through their 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And they're doing the math, Jim. It's a good sign. I went back to Nashville and I started through this aftercare plan that they laid out for me. And they said, stay away from your old playmates and playgrounds. My favorite watering hole in Nashville, Tennessee is on 8th Avenue South. And I had a 2-year chip in my pocket the next time my car was on 8th Avenue South. I'm not kidding. I was that serious about it. They said go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 87. I tried hard. I can't remember the other two, but there was one particular evening. I mean, I'm about to reach for the car keys to go to the meeting, and my young son decided to learn to dance standing up on a rocking chair. And we went to the emergency rooms through the meeting. I think everybody here said that was a good call. Yeah, that's a good call. And you see, I thought when you'd missed, you just missed. I didn't go, that you could go to 2 meetings in a day. See, because I got newcomer thinking, terminal case. I completed this psychobabble 4-step guide that they were using at the treatment center. I cleaned up my language, so I can't tell you what I think about that today. I would like to recommend the actual 4-step. It's in the big book, by the way. It's a very powerful exercise, and it's not much of its writing. Some of its writing. The 4-step is a series of lists, observations, and prayers. My experience is that the writing portion of the 4-step has little, if any, therapeutic effect. The observations and prayers are life-changing. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please get with me tonight, or see somebody else who just grinned and nodded, because this 4-step's great. But anyway, I finished this fill-in-the-blank multiple choice, do you still hate your mother, 4-step, this thing they had. And I called down to the treatment center to Bernie. He had not been my counselor. He was a counselor down there. But the reason I asked him to hear my 5th step, had my big white light experience, knew I was going to have to do it. And the reason I asked him is because you could look at him and tell he was stoned out of his mind. Well, you know what it looks like. His face is real relaxed. He's got this dumb grin. When he walks real slow. You know, it's like somebody's ripped. I thought, I'm taking my 5th step with this junkie. 2 weeks later, will he know what I said? He won't know if we did it. He's a great choice. I called and said, sure, with schedule. I drove down, took my 5th step with Bernie, which is where I began to get relief. For those of you who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the steps look to you like they're designed to punish you, welcome to AA. That's how they look to us. We were wrong about that, and you are too. If I'd been taking the steps out of the book with a sponsor, I'd have been getting relief way before then. All right, the steps actually brought me relief. That's been my experience with them. But anyway, I took my 5th step with Bernie, and just as an aside, by the way, Bernie was not stoned. Bernie was sober over 20 years. That was serenity. I didn't know what it looked like. I got... Newcomer thinking, terminal case, right? I get back to Nashville. The only thing I haven't done that's on my aftercare list is get a sponsor. I was so insane. Well, let's see. This is a 2-word fill in the blank. This one's harder, okay? Let's see if you can do this 2-word fill in the blank. I was so insane, I was looking for a sponsor I could relate to. Isn't that not crazy? Oh, my God. Oh, I'm so grateful I couldn't find a sponsor I could relate to. I mean, I can't figure out you go to 2 meetings in a day. Who can I relate to? Oh, I can relate to some other newcomer that don't know his fanny from a hot rock. That's who I can relate to. Thank God I didn't find a sponsor I could relate to. We'd both be dead by now. I needed a sponsor I would obey. It was a new concept. And finally, there was a guy at this meeting and his lights were on. Do you know what I mean? You look at him and tell something was working in his life. And I wanted to feel like he looked. And I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, here's your first assignment. I said, assignment? I thought a sponsor was kind of like a big brother going to show you the ropes and maybe fix your wife, loan you some money. That's one of those other things I was wrong about, too. Newcomer thingy, right? Ask me later. I'll be glad to tell you. I cannot take the time tonight. And I came back a week later. I said, Jerry, I did the assignment. He said, good, I'll sponsor you my way. I said, what does that mean exactly? He said, you are too sick to stay sober on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I did not have any idea what he was talking about. And Jerry had terminal. Anyway, he outlived what the doctor said by about a decade. That's pretty common here. And he said to the end of his life, he thought the single best kept secret in our fellowship is the definition of our program. The way we keep it secret, of course, is that we read it at every meeting. It's on page 59 in the text. There's a sentence immediately before step one where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a... No steps, no program. Steps are not part of the program. They are the program. No steps, no program. We're committing murder with a phrase, and the phrase is don't drink and go to meetings. We're killing them with that. We are killing people with that. Now, I got a question for you. If sitting around with a bunch of other alcoholics talking about our problems is going to get people sober, wouldn't the guys under the Woodland Street Bridge in Nashville, Tennessee be sober right now? You bet they would. And it doesn't work for them, and it doesn't work for us. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. The program is the 12 steps. Hard as they look, they're not as hard as the life I was living. And they turned out to be very, very easy, a little piece at a time. And so Jerry said, you're going to have to do the 12 steps. And I was honest. I want to recommend, be honest with your sponsor. I said, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. I'd look ahead at 9. I wasn't even sure you were serious about that. I said, I don't want to do the 12 steps. He said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. Jerry, I don't believe we're communicating. He said, we are communicating. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when you do what your sponsor says, whether you want to or not. Ooh. Why do I have to do the 12 steps? Jerry didn't answer why questions from the men he sponsored except for this one. I don't either. He said, the reason I want to answer your why questions is step one, section B says you're not in management. Why is a management question? Consequently, all of the why questions have the same answer. And the answer is you don't need to know. And I hated it when I heard that. And today I love it. It's one of my cornerstones. Because I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. It was needing to know. It was making me crazy. Yeah. And the only why question a man ever answered for me was this one. Why do I have to do this 12 steps? And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. It's the only easy assignment the man ever gave me. And he says, what we're going to do with this garbage can, with these steps, is we're going to dump you out, clean the can, and stand you back upright. We're going to fish through your life. Most of it's garbage. We're going to throw it away. But portions of it are good, and we will keep those portions. He gave two examples. He said, do you love your children? I said, I love them so much. He said, great, we will keep that. And then he got smart with me. He said, when you go to work, you do a good job? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, we'll keep some of that. When we get finished with these 12 steps, you'll be a big, clean can with just a little good stuff in the bottom. Because you see, our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We've got to drill before we can fill. Steps 4 through 9 are about digging the poison out of your soul. We've got to drill before we can fill. Because if we just fill with the good stuff, the bad stuff's still in there. It's going to detonate one of these days. The good news is, like the dentist, we got Novocaine. Here we call it home group, sponsorship, fellowship, and love. And they work fine. It's not that hard. And he said, the reason you have to do that is the 12 steps is because alcohol is not your problem. What? Alcohol is not your problem. It's your answer. So it makes you tall enough and smart enough and good-looking enough and able to talk to the ladies, and it allows you to come out and play. It lets you be a member of the human race. It's the only answer you've ever known. And if you're going to lay down that answer, you're going to have a new answer. And the new answer is going to have to be at least as good as the old answer. I could quit for a long period. I could quit forever, which, as you know, is somewhere between 20 minutes and about 8 weeks. Right? The earth people are very confused about that forever thing. Boy, you can't believe how long they think that goes. And I could quit, but I couldn't stay unthirsty. Something was going to happen one of these days that I was going to get thirsty. I was going to get fired. I was going to get promoted. The Redskins are going to play the Cowboys on Monday night. Right? Something is going to happen where I'm going to get rendered thirsty again. Right? And I've been here 20 years, and I'm hearing them say one day at a time, and I know they mean that, but I'll tell you what they really mean is one day at a time in a row. Okay? They mean in a row. And if I'm going to get the in the row part, they're going to have to render me unthirsty. They're going to have to render me unthirsty. And I'd like to quote to you for what for me is the most powerful promise we have. It's the first line in page 60 where it says 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's what it says, the. It doesn't say A, it says the. That means one. This is my experience. Spiritually awakened people do not drink beverage alcohol. And they never get thirsty. Ever. No matter what. And that was my experience.
as I finally surrendered, allowed this man to coach me through the 12 steps. He said, the reason you need the big can with the little stuff in the bottom, the reason you need that clean space is one of these days something is just going to slam into your heart. He said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big clean can with an empty space to store that pain in while we love you back to spiritual health, you'll escape. That's what you are. You're an escape artist. And the only escapes you know are killing you and devastating everyone around you. And I just finally said, okay. And I let the man coach me through the 12 steps. And I've had a spiritual awakening as the result. And I've been unthirsty since December of 84. I remember my last urge. It's been gone that long. So those of you who are driving around hanging onto the wheel to keep it from turning into the convenience store to get a six-pack, right? I'm not. And you won't either if you get a sponsor. I'd like to read to you what looks to me like the definition of sponsorship out of the text. Page 96, they've been talking for a couple of pages about a 12-step call. It says, suppose you're now making your second visit to a man. It says, he has read this volume, says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. For me, that's someone who's sponsorable. He's read this book, or he's tried to. And he realizes he has to, I love the language, he has to go through the 12 steps. I'll go through with the 12 steps. That's close enough. We don't get too many people coming through the door eager to do the 12 steps, right? And then I think it defines sponsor. It says, having had the experience yourself, you can give me much practical advice. Experience. Experience of going through the 12 steps, what advice? Advice on how to go through the 12 steps. Sponsorship in two sentences, page 96. There it is. Because anything beyond that, I'm trying to manage their life. I can't manage mine. How can I manage his? I don't know if he needs to get a dog, get divorced, get married, move to San Diego. How would I know? I know this, if he'll allow me to coach him through the 12 steps straight out of this book and stay active carrying the message, he'll be with us a long time. I'm going to be controversial again. I apologize for that. But I'm not sincere. I have personally not yet seen anyone in and out of this program. I've seen a couple hundred thousand in and out of the fellowship. I have not seen anybody actually do the 12 steps out of this. Do take, work the steps. If not, learn, interpret, or understand. Right, but actually do the steps out of this book with a sponsor who's already done them and stay active carrying our message and drink again. Anybody here seen that? Y'all been putting your hands up all night. I don't see any. 347 people is what the man said. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Our path is the 12 steps according to the Ford of the third edition. And nobody here has seen anyone in and out of the program. How about that? That's what I came to tell you. The rest of this is just bait. You know, I'm going to tell you a horror story. I'm going to tell it fast. Embrace this. It has a happy ending. My precious daughter fired a pistol into her mouth a few years ago. And I found her a number of hours later. We rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital. Y'all started a prayer meeting. In 20 minutes, there was 20 of you there. By dark, it looked just like this. I don't know how long that went on. They told us for the first 4 days that this little girl is going to be dying real soon. We can't save her. 4 days is a long time. And I think if I hadn't had the big clean can, I'd have committed murder that night or probably the next day. And this story wouldn't have the happy ending that it does. I'd like to tell you who you are because some of you may not know. My home group put a 24-hour watch on me. I didn't leave Vanderbilt Hospital for 60 days. You guys put a 24-hour watch on me. There was not a time for the next 60 days when a member of my home group, at least as close to me as Jim is right here. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can pretend to care, folks. You cannot pretend to show up. You showed up. And it wasn't to keep me from drinking. It was so one of my people could hold me if I needed to cry at 3 in the morning. That's why you were there. I've learned to cry since I've been here. I had to work on it. I had to be taught. By the way, if you'd like to learn to cry, if you'll see me, I wrote it up. I'm serious about that. It's amazing how many people need to cry and can't. I think my emotions are how my spirit communicates to my mind and my body. I've had the experience of my mind and body running the show qualified me to sit in closed meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous and most of the other fellowships you've ever heard of. I can't afford the price of that. And my emotions are how my spirit talks to my mind and body. So I need that channel to be open. I had to learn to cry. That's part of who I am. Now, there may be people here that disrespect me because I'm a man that cries. I hope you don't. But I'm okay if you do. I hope you like me. I'm okay if you do. One of my mentors used to say, I'd rather be despised for who I am than loved for who I'm not. See, I'm okay with me now. I'm okay with me. That's a huge change. My daughter lives. She's doing great. She sends you love. She and her husband just bought their first house. We were down to Atlanta with them this past week. She's doing fantastic. I sponsor a man whose son did not. Actually, I sponsored two. I'm just going to quote one of them. His son died. He was actually killed under very ugly circumstances. This man did not drink again. I just gave him his 19-year chip. But emotionally, he was gone for a very long time. You get up close to his face and scream, and he could not hear you. He's back now. He's doing fantastic. And this is what he said. He said, one of these days, you'll have to go to the mountain all by yourself. If you haven't done the work out of this book and you can't reach up and take God's hand, you're not going to be able to go. I believe that. I hope you get the work done before the next one hits. We do a lot of promises around here. Let me read you one you may not like. Page 14. Here's a promise for you. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. I promise you, trials and low spots. Hope you get the work done. That's what this thing is about. It's about being able to handle this as it comes. I started going to a clubhouse when I got to Nashville sober, and they had slogans on the wall. One of them said, one day at a time. I knew what that meant. I mean, don't drink today. Well, if you're new, it means that. But I'll tell you what else. Eventually, that won't be enough. What one day at a time means to me is live only in this day. The first 10 steps are about me cleaning up my past. I don't have to look over my shoulders. Nothing gaining on me. 11 and 12 are about me embracing the great truth that this loving, gentle God that created the galaxies of the duck-billed platypus and all that stuff holds my future, right? I got a friend who says he spends too much time in his head trying to clear away the wreckage of his future. Okay, I cleaned up my past. A loving God holds my future. Those two facts combine to free me to live one day at a time in this day. If I don't have both of those in place, I can't be here. That's in part what the 12 steps are about. One of the slogans said, let go and let God. I wonder how they do that. And one of them said, first things first. I understand that, but I'm a newcomer. Of course, I'm not doing it. And but there was one, the only one up there I was actually doing, and it made me crazy to look at it, was think. Oh, man, I have that covered. Oh, hey, newcomers, get ready for this. If you believe this, you'll be impressed. I only have one thought at a time. And there's occasionally a space between them where it's just quiet. Yeah. Stick around. It could happen to you. All right. I don't find that think in my literature. So I've come up with my own definition. Take this if you can use it. To me, think. That means three thinks is the limit. Whatever it is I can think about once is good, twice is good. I can think about it the third time. If I have thought about it three times, I must lay it down. For if I were going to outthink it, I would have outthunk it in three thinks. If I go to the fourth think, I got a problem with step one, section B, I'm trying to manage it. As a matter of fact, absolutely anything that I'm upset about is because I'm trying to manage it. It's a step one, section B problem. Everything from international politics to the way you drive your car to the fact that the spectacular woman I'm married to puts the toilet paper on the roll backwards. It should feed over the top, as you well know. Thank you. Well, she's getting this tape, I'll tell you. She'll get this one. Should feed over the top. I fixed the one in the men's room. It should feed over the top, but she puts it on the other way. She says, because we got a cat. I've been watching that cat for almost 9 years, and he don't use it. It's good to be in a room full of people whose brains misfire on the same rhythm as mine. When I was new, I was saying insane things like, I'm having a good day or I'm having a bad day. Let me think about it. If I say I'm having a good day, what am I really saying? What I'm really saying is, Scott's will is being done today. If I say I'm having a bad day, what am I really saying? Scott's will is not being done today. I think Scott's will is one of the biggest problems I've got, or there are a number of mistakes in the big book. It's one or the other. I have to try to move on. I moved out of the home my first wife and I were living in when I was sober 6 years. And she told one of the kids not too long ago that when I got sober, I changed, and she didn't, and I think that's what happened. And I'm not indicting her. I did an awful lot of things to make her sick. I stand guilty as charged. All right? This is not about me taking her inventory. I pray for her often. I wish her the best. But she was tearing into me one more time, and I'm 6 feet and 200 pounds, and she's 5'5 and 105. And I got a moment of clarity. And the moment of clarity was that I'm just before giving her a straight right to the face. And when she goes down, I'm going with her. She's on the way to the hospital. I'm on the way to the jail. It's a bad plan. And I turned around and walked out the door, started looking for an apartment. And 48 hours later, I moved. And I did not know what to do. I'm not terribly religious, but I don't believe in divorce. And yet I knew if I lived with her, it was a question of time before I was going to beat her up. And I was given a gift. And I share it with you only in the hope that maybe somebody here can use it. What I was given was three prayers, and I prayed them each morning. The first prayer was, God, if it's your will for us to be together, put us together. And the second one, if it's your will for us to be apart, put us apart. Those are the easy ones. Here's the third one that counts. God, if it's your will for me not to know today, leave me not knowing. For me, that's step one, section B, prayer form. His guidance would be here right on time. And then I need to lay it down and move on. And I didn't know for several years, and we got divorced. Miss Linda, my now and forever bride, she and I are celebrating. We just celebrated 10 years of marriage. We're having a fabulous time. This has nothing to do with recovery or anything except that this is. Let me introduce you to my wife. She's not here, but this will give you an idea. We're sitting watching the U.S. Open golf tournament on TV. This Japanese fellow's in contention. He hits a really bad shot. They come in tight on his face. He looks like he's in anguish. Miss Linda says, "Oh, I hope he doesn't commit karaoke." I hope so too. I've been there when people have committed karaoke. It's a terrible thing. He'll last a long time. Anyway, that's my wife. If you disagree with something I've had to say, I'd love to hear from you. Not talk to you, but hear from you. I may learn, please. I walked out of a meeting in my home group, and a guy whose sponsor I sponsor said I disagree. And what I'd said was that my amends to my children would never be complete. And he said, "That's not right. Did you go to your children and tell them what you'd done wrong? Did you ask for their forgiveness? Did you ask how you could make it right? And did you do that to the best of your ability?" I said, "Yeah, to all of that." He said, "You're trying to be the best father you can be today isn't 9-step work. It's 12. It's the principles in all your affairs. And if you think it's 9-step work, you have not accepted their forgiveness or God's or your own, and you have work to do." My book doesn't use the term living amends or continuing amends. If you're making them, it's okay with me. I came down off the cross that day. I'm trying to be a good dad today. It's not 9-step work. I sure am watching some kids manipulate us into doing some pretty sick stuff under the guise of you were a lousy parent in the past. Doesn't have to happen. My 9-step's complete with my children. And I say that only because I got free. I'm going to say this only because I got free. This is a political hot one. I'm not talking politics here. I'm going to tell you how I voted. I voted by secret ballot. And I hope you did. And I hope you won't go past that anywhere in or near an AA meeting. Please. Please, we cannot afford to get off of what we do here. This one's a political hot potato. If you've done what I'm about to say and you're good with it, I'm good with it. I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about how I got free. As a young man, I paid for an abortion. And I used to drink over that and the what-ifs that went with it. And that's what I was thinking of that night in the treatment center when I had that white light experience and received the forgiveness. When I got to step 9, it looked to me like I owed amends to an unborn child. I didn't think it could be done. From my early days, I've been in the hands of people who knew this book. This is page 83. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. It is my experience that as the fourth step is not about writing, but it's about observations and prayers. I didn't say there wasn't writing in it. I say it's not about writing. It's observations and prayers. In my experience, this letter is not about writing. It is about tears. I've had the privilege of working with a number of people who've needed to write a letter to an unborn child or a grandparent or somebody who's gone. And it's not about writing. It is about the tears. I have written up the things that I was given on how to do this. If you have or know someone who might be able to use that, please see me after this meeting. I brought a bunch of them. And I'd love to pass them out. But I got free. Nothing happened in here when I told you about that. And that's an awfully big thing to me, to have gotten absolutely free of that. I want to talk about anonymity a minute, because it's something we don't talk about a lot. I give my last name in AA meetings in keeping with our tradition of anonymity. If that did not make any sense to you, I'd like to recommend the pamphlet Understanding Anonymity and the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Please, have a read. Anonymity, in part, has to do with doing something good for somebody else and not getting caught. That's not my style. I'm rather under the applause. And I had an opportunity a number of years ago, and I did something nice for somebody, didn't get caught. And I could think about that any time of the day or night. And it was like there was a piece of sunshine about the size of a golf ball in my chest. And I could think about what I did, and this thing would glow and send light through my whole body. And I'm not trying to be poetic. I see some people nodding who know what I'm talking about. And I never told a soul about that for about 6 months. And when I told, that piece of sunshine got out. So I can tell you, what it is, I took a small boy fishing. I was fishing in a park, and there was a family, and the kid was about six, and he locked on my leg. And anyway, a series, and 6 months later, I guess he was maybe eight, I put him in the front of a canoe, and we floated the Buffalo River, which is a national scenic river about an hour from Nashville. And we floated 5 miles of river. We caught over 100 fish that day. And this kid caught a 4-pound smallmouth bass. He got my fish. But I'm okay with it. And about a mile from the takeout, there's nowhere to get out of this river. And all of a sudden, the sky blackens, and we are fixing to get it. We came down a little run, and there was an eddy. And canoeists call it eddy out, where you kind of parallel park the canoe in a backwater under some trees. And the bottom was about to fall. I'm just about to give God a little piece of it. Did you happen to notice St. Scott down here with a little boy in the fishing? And he got my, just about to do that. And this beautiful little boy looks over at my shoulder at me and he says, "Is it okay to fish here?" And I forget that. I prayed that third step prayer in a minute. And I forget that. That when the sky blackens in my life, and it's not going like I want it to, that's the question I'm supposed to take to my Father. Is it okay to fish here? Because that's what I signed on to do. The chance to carry this message is so wonderful for me. I've received such gifts here tonight. I stand before you in stocking feet. We invited God into the room. I could be standing on holy ground. I've tried to carry that in my heart. And it's been such a gift to me to be here with you. I want to thank that God for an open heart. I asked for one. I got it. I hope you did. And if you borrowed my God and you got touched, borrow him again. Try it again. When I was living in that little apartment, I'd carry a picture of myself taken when I was about 4 years old. Beautiful little boy. I'll show you the picture if you ask me. And I had it blown up 2 feet wide and 3 feet high, and I had it on the wall at the foot of the bed, and I didn't know why. And I'm living there in terminal celibacy, and I was looking at I shouldn't have done that, I'm sorry, but I was laying there looking at that little boy one night, and it wasn't too long after that picture was taken I started being abused, and I was abused for a long time after that. And I want you to know that nothing happened in here when I just told you that, because I've been through the forgiveness process, which is in the fourth step. I know there are people here that do not know what I'm talking about. Please talk to me after this meeting. Forgiveness process is in step four, and it's not about writing. And but I was looking at that picture, and I wondered, who would he have become, the beautiful little child of God, if all those things had not happened to me and I hadn't done the horrible things that I did? Who would he have become? And I got my answer. And the answer is, it is my job to become the man that he would have become. That's my assignment. The only instructions I've ever found that work for me are in this book. And I'm in the process. The question is, do I accept the assignment? Are you willing to grow into the gentle, loving person that God intended you to be? I'm going to soapbox again. I don't think I've ever done this in a group before. The term unconditional love upsets me. Love, by definition, is unconditional. I grew up with conditional acceptance and conditional approval where the love should have been. And that's why I buy terms like unconditional love. Love is always unconditional. If there are conditions, I don't think it's love. My last flight in a high-performance aircraft, I leveled at 40,000 feet, 3.5 minutes from brake release. And the guy gave me a barrel. It's a 30-mile circle around a point. If you're going to play at 9/10 of the speed of sound, they have to give you some space. And we weren't supposed to be above 45,000 feet in this airplane for any reason. It's very, very, very dangerous. And I'm just kind of curious. Well, I wonder how high we'll go. And I'm going to tell you, because I found out. I pulled the nose up a little bit, rolled her into some bank. I'm in military power. It's everything short of afterburner. And I'm climbing. I'm doing an instrument climb inside the circle. And I thought I was going to get to 10 miles at 52,300 feet. She was done. She would not go up anymore. I leveled off, and I looked for the first time. I was 80 miles west of Jacksonville, Florida, out over the Okefenokee Swamp. It was about 9:30 on a clear day. The sun was coming up over my right shoulder. The sky above me was black at 52,300 feet on a clear day at 9:30 in the morning. And I looked out to the west and saw the curvature of the earth. And I don't mean a little bit. I mean, I saw it. This thing we are riding is this magnificent blue ball floating in space, held there by love, I guess. Didn't seem to be anything else there. And in the poem High Flight, the author says, I reached out my hand and touched the face of God. And I know what he means. I did that day. It was like something warm had been poured on me. And I sat there about 30 seconds and eased the throttles back and came down and landed. I couldn't tell anybody. If they believe me, I'm going to get court-martialed. I'm smarter than that. I think, Jim tonight, I was the town drunk. I wasn't the village idiot. So, I don't tell them. I kind of forgot about it. And a fellow named Burke Harlan was one of my mentors, and Burke's gone now. And I spoke at his 12-year birthday when I had a 5-year chip in my pocket. And I heard myself telling that story. And I said out loud, I wonder why I'm telling this. I got to the end and found out, which you already know, is my first spiritual experience. And I treasure it, and I love the chance to tell it because I saw it again. For over 30 years, I've wanted to see that again. On June the 29th of 2003, Miss Linda and I chartered a Lear 31 and took two of the kids. And it'll go to 51,000 feet, folks, and that's close enough. I heard someone get in the chip tonight and say, your dreams can come true. Dream big. We serve a big God. I got a program bigger than all the things that happened to me, bigger than I can dream. I serve a God who forgives me for everything I ever did, and He loved me while I was doing it. I don't have the power to make a mistake so ugly that God can't turn it into something magnificent, not just fix, but turn it into something magnificent. That's who I am. That's who He is. I don't have the power. I don't have the power. I don't care what you've done. You didn't have the power either. This thing is bigger than all of that. I was at a little meeting in Knoxville a couple of years ago, and a little discussion meeting, 12 people in the room, they expect you to talk. Come around, there's this old crusty-looking guy with an attitude case, I can't wait. And they got to him, and he said, I've just come back from an ancient ritual, from a medieval ceremony where 10,000 people sat in an unair-conditioned auditorium wearing long robes. I figured it out. That's graduation, University of Tennessee. That was commencement. I got it. I got it all by myself. And he said Alex Haley was the featured speaker, the guy that wrote Roots. He spoke a lot around there. And Alex Haley was not talking about AA. But what he said reminded this guy so much of AA that he forgot about the air conditioning and the robes and started thinking about how great recovery was. And what Alex Haley said that to me defines us so beautifully was this. He said, if you ever see a turtle sitting up on top of a fence post, you'll know he's had help. God bless you all, and thank you for the help.